Chapter 5, The 10 Peaks of Human Progress. In the year 1794, a young French aristocrat by the magnificent name of Marquis Jean-Marie de Condorcet was hiding from the guillotine in a little attic room on the outskirts of Paris. There, far from any friend, lest the coming of a friend should reveal his hiding place, he wrote the most optimistic book ever penned by the hand of man, Esquisse d'un tableau des progrès de l'esprit humain, a sketch of a tableau of the progress of the human spirit. Eloquently, he described the recent liberation of science from the shackles of superstition, and gloried in the triumphs of Newton. Quote, given 100 years of liberated knowledge and universal free education, he said, and all social problems will, at the close of the next century, have been solved. There is no limit to progress, except the duration of the globe upon which we are placed. Close quote. Having completed his little manuscript, Condorcet handed it to his hostess. Then, in the dark of night, he fled to a distant village inn and flung his tired body upon a bed. When he awoke, he found himself surrounded by the police. Taking from his pocket a vial of poison which he had carried for this culminating chapter of his romance, Condorcet drank it to the last drop, and then fell into the arms of his captors, dead. I have never ceased to marvel that a man so placed, driven to the very last stand of hope, with all his personal sacrifices of aristocratic privilege and fortune gone for nothing, with that great revolution upon which the youth of all Europe had pinned its hopes for a better world issuing in indiscriminate suspicion and terror, should, instead of writing an epic of despondency and gloom, have written a paean to progress. Never before had man so believed in mankind, and perhaps never again since. Search through all ancient Greek and Latin literature, and you will find no affirmatory belief in human progress. Not until the Occident brought into the Orient the virus of, the fever of, progress, can you find in any Hindu or Chinese thinker any belief in the notion that man marches forward through the years. It is a relatively new idea for men to have and to hold. Progress, a definition. What shall we mean by progress? Subjective definitions will not do. We must not conceive progress in terms of one nation or one religion or one code of morals. An increase of kindness, for example, would alarm our young Nietzscheans. Nor may we define progress in terms of happiness, for idiots are happier than geniuses, and those whom we most respect seek not happiness but greatness. Is it possible to find an objective definition for our term, one that will hold for any individual, any group, even for any species? Let us provisionally define progress as, quote, increasing control of the environment by life, close quote. And let us mean by environment, quote, all the circumstances that condition the coordination and realization of desire, close quote. Progress is the domination of chaos by mind and purpose, of matter by form and will. It need not be continuous in order to be real. There may be plateaus in it, dark ages, and disheartening retrogressions. But if the last stage is the highest of all, we shall say that man makes progress. And in assessing epochs and nations, we must guard against loose thinking. We must not compare nations in their youth with nations in the mellowness of their cultural maturity. And we must not compare the worst or the best of one age with the selected best or worst of all the collected past. If we find that the type of genius prevalent in young countries like America and Australia tends to the executive, explorative, and scientific kind, rather than to the painter of pictures or poems, the carver of statues or words, we shall understand that each age and place calls for and needs certain brands of genius rather than others, and that the cultural sort can only come when its practical predecessors have cleared the forest and prepared the way. If we find that civilizations come and go and mortality is upon all the works of man, we shall confess the irrefutability of death and be consoled if, during the day of our lives and our nations, we move slowly upward and become a little better than we were. If we find that philosophers are of slighter stature now than in the days of broad-back Plato and the substantial Socrates, that our sculptors are lesser men than Donatello or Angelo, our painters inferior to Velázquez, our poets and composers unnameable with Shelley and Bach, we shall not despair. These stars did not all shine on the same night. Our problem is whether the total and average level of human ability has increased and stands at its peak today. When we take a total view and compare our modern existence, precarious and chaotic as it is, with the ignorance, superstition, brutality, cannibalism, and diseases of primitive peoples, we are a little comforted. The lowest strata of our race may still differ only slightly from such men, but above those strata, thousands and millions have reached to mental and moral heights inconceivable, presumably, to the early mind. Under the complex strain of city life, we sometimes take imaginative refuge in the quiet simplicity of savage days. But in our less romantic moments, we know that this is a flight reaction from our actual tasks, that the idolatry of barbarism, like so many of our young opinions, is merely an impatient expression of adolescent maladaptation, part of the suffering involved in the contemporary retardation of individual maturity. A study of such savage tribes, as survive, shows their high rate of infantile mortality, their short tenure of life, their inferior speed, their inferior stamina, their inferior will, and their superior plagues. The friendly and flowing savage is like nature, delightful, but for the insects and the dirt. The savage, however, might turn the argument around and inquire how we enjoy our politics and our wars, and whether we think ourselves happier than the tribes whose weird names resound in the textbooks of anthropology. The believer in progress will have to admit that we have made too many advances in the art of war, and that our politicians, with startling exceptions, could have adorned the Roman Forum in the days of Milo and Clodius. As to happiness, no man can say. It is an elusive angel, destroyed by detection and seldom amenable to measurement. Presumably, it depends first upon health, secondly upon love, and thirdly upon wealth. As to wealth, we make such progress that it lies on the conscience of our intellectuals. As to love, we try to atone for our lack of depth by unprecedented inventiveness and variety. Our thousand fads of diet and drugs predispose us to the belief that we must be ridden with disease as compared with simpler men in simpler days. But this is a delusion. We think that where there are so many doctors, there must be more sickness than before. But in truth, we have not more ailments than in the past, but only more money. Our wealth allows us to treat and cherish and master illnesses from which primitive men died without even knowing their Greek name. The outline of history. Having made these admissions and modifications, let us try to see the problem of progress in a total view. When we look at history in the large, we see it as a graph of rising and falling states, nations and cultures disappearing as on some gigantic film. But in that irregular movement of countries and that chaos of men, certain great moments stand out as the peaks and essence of human history, certain advances which, once made, were never lost. Step by step, man has climbed from the savage to the scientist, and these are the stages of his growth. 1. Speech. Think of it not as a sudden achievement, nor as a gift from the gods, but as the slow development of articulate expression through centuries of effort from the mating calls of animals to the lyric flights of poetry. Without words or common nouns that might give to particular images the ability to represent a class, generalization would have stopped in its beginnings, and reason would have stayed where we find it in the brute. Without words, philosophy and poetry, history and prose would have been impossible, and thought could never have reached the subtlety of Einstein or Anatole France. Without words, man could not have become man, nor woman, woman. 2. Fire. Fire made man independent of climate, gave him a greater compass on the earth, tempered his tools to hardness and durability, and offered him as food a thousand things inedible before. Not least of all, it made him master of the night, and shed an animating brilliance over the hours of evening and dawn. Picture the dark before man conquered it. Even now the terrors of that primitive abyss survive in our traditions, and perhaps in our blood. Once every twilight was a tragedy, and man crept into his cave at sunset, trembling with fear. Now we do not creep into our caves until sunrise, and though it is folly to miss the sun, how good it is to be liberated from our ancient fears. This overspreading of the night with a billion man-made stars has brightened the human spirit, and made for a vivacious jollity in modern life. We shall never be grateful enough for light. 3. The conquest of the animals. Our memories are too forgetful, and our imagination too unimaginative, to let us realize the boon we have in our security from the larger and subhuman beasts of prey. Animals are now our playthings and our helpless food, but there was a time when man was hunted as well as hunter, and when every step from cave or hut was an adventure, and the possession of the earth was still at stake. This war to make the planet human was surely the most vital in human history. By its side, all other wars were but family quarrels, achieving nothing. That struggle between strength of body and power of mind was waged through long and unrecorded years, and when at last it was won, the fruit of man's triumph, his safety on the earth, was transmitted across a thousand generations, with 100 other gifts from the past, to be part of our heritage at birth. What are all our temporary retrogressions against the background of such a conflict and such a victory? 4. Agriculture. Civilization was impossible in the hunting stage. It called for a permanent habitat, a settled way of life. It came with the home and the school, and these could not be till the products of the field replaced the animals of the forest or the herd as the food of man. The hunter found his quarry with increasing difficulty, while the woman whom he left at home tended an ever more fruitful soil. This patient husbandry by the wife threatened to make her independent of the male, and for his own lordship's sake he forced himself at last to the prose of tillage. No doubt it took centuries to make this greatest of all transitions in human history, but when at last it was made, civilization began. Meredith said that woman will be the last creature to be civilized by man. He was wrong, as it is possible to be in the limits of one sentence. For civilization came through two things chiefly: the home, which developed those social dispositions that form the psychological cement of society, and agriculture, which took man from his wandering life as hunter, herder, and killer, and settled him long enough in one place to let him build homes, schools, churches, colleges, universities, civilization. But it was woman who gave man agriculture and the home. She domesticated man as she domesticated the sheep and the pig. Man is woman's last domestic animal, and perhaps he is the last creature that will be civilized by woman. The task is just begun. One look at our menus reveals us as still in the hunting stage. 5. Social organization. Here are two men disputing. One knocks the other down, kills him, and then concludes that he who was alive must have been right, and that he who was dead must have been wrong. A mode of demonstration still accepted in international disputes. Here are two other men disputing. One says to the other, "Let us not fight. We may both be killed. Let us take our difference to some elder of the tribe and submit to his decision." It was a crucial moment in human history. For if the answer was no, barbarism continued. If it was yes, civilization planted another root in the memory of man: the replacement of chaos with order, of brutality with judgment, of violence with law. Here, too, it is a gift unfelt, because we are born within the charm circle of its protection, and never know its value till we wander into the disordered or solitary regions of the earth. God knows that our congresses and our parliaments are dubious inventions, the distilled mediocrity of the land, but despite them, we manage to enjoy a security of life and property which we shall appreciate more warmly when civil war or revolution reduces us to primitive conditions. Compare the safety of travel today with the robber-infested highways of medieval Europe. Never before in history was there such order and liberty as exist in England today, and may someday exist in America, when a way is found of opening municipal office to capable and honorable men. However, we must not excite ourselves too much about political corruption or democratic mismanagement. Politics is not life, but only a graft upon life. Under its vulgar melodrama, the traditional order of society quietly persists. In the family, in the school, in the thousand devious influences that change our native lawlessness into some measure of cooperation and goodwill. Without consciousness of it, we partake in a luxurious patrimony of social order built up for us by 100 generations of trial and error, accumulated knowledge, and transmitted wealth. 6. Morality. Here we touch the very heart of our problem. Are men morally better than they were? So far as intelligence is an element in morals, we have improved. The average of intelligence is higher, and there has been a great increase in the number of what we may vaguely call developed minds. So far as character is concerned, we have probably retrogressed. Subtlety of thought has grown at the expense of stability of soul. In the presence of our fathers, we intellectuals feel uncomfortably that, though we surpass them in the number of ideas that we have crowded into our heads, and though we have liberated ourselves from delightful superstitions which still bring them aid and comfort, we are inferior to them in uncomplaining courage, fidelity to our tasks and purposes, and simple strength of personality. But if morality implies the virtues exalted in the code of Christ, we have made some halting progress despite our mines and slums, our democratic corruption, and our urban addiction to lechery. We are a slightly gentler species than we were, capable of greater kindness and of generosity even to alien or recently hostile peoples whom we have never seen. In one year, 1928, the contributions of our country to private charity and philanthropy exceeded $2 billion, which was then one half of all the money circulating in America. We still kill murderers if, as occasionally happens, we catch them and convict them, but we are a little uneasy about this ancient retributive justice of a life for a life, and the number of crimes for which we mete out the ultimate punishment has rapidly decreased. 200 years ago, in Merry England, men might be hanged by justification of the law for stealing a shilling, and people are still severely punished if they do not steal a great deal. Not that many hundred years ago, miners were hereditary serfs in Scotland. Criminals were legally and publicly tortured to death in France. Debtors were imprisoned for life in England, and respectable people raided the African coast for slaves. Less than 100 years ago, our jails were dens of filth and horror, colleges for the graduation of minor criminals into major criminals. Now our prisons are vacation resorts for tired murderers. We still exploit the lower strata of our working classes, but we soothe our consciences with welfare work. Eugenics struggles to balance, with artificial selection, the interference of human kindliness and benevolence with that merciless elimination of the weak and the infirm, which was once the mainspring of natural selection. We think there is more violence in the world than before, but in truth there are only more newspapers. Vast and powerful organizations scour the planet for crimes and scandals that will console their readers for stenography and monogamy. And all the villainy and politics of five continents are gathered upon one page for the encouragement of our breakfasts. We conclude that half the world is killing the other half, and that a large proportion of the remainder are committing suicide. But in the streets, in our homes, in public assemblies, in 1,000 vehicles of transportation, we are astonished to find no murderers and no suicides, but rather a blunt democratic courtesy, and an unpretentious chivalry, 100 times more real than when men mouthed chivalric phrases, enslaved their women, and ensured the fidelity of their wives with irons, while they fought for Christ in the Holy Land. Our prevailing mode of marriage, chaotic and deliquescent as it is, represents a pleasant refinement on marriage by capture or purchase, and le droit des seigneurs. There is less brutality between men and women, between parents and children, between teachers and pupils, than in any recorded generation of the past. The emancipation of woman and her ascendancy over man indicate an unprecedented gentility in the once murderous male. Love, which was unknown to primitive men, or was only a hunger of the flesh, has flowered into a magnificent garden of song and sentiment, in which the passion of a man for a maid, though vigorously rooted in physical need, rises like incense into the realm of living poetry. And youth, whose sins so disturb its tired elders, atones for its little vices with such intellectual eagerness and moral courage as may be invaluable when education resolves at last to come out into the open and cleanse our public life. 7. Tools. In the face of the Romantics, the machine wreckers of the intelligentsia, the pleaders for a return to the primitive, dirt, chores, snakes, cobwebs, bugs, we sing the song of the tools, the engines, the machines that have enslaved and are liberating man. We need not be ashamed of our prosperity. It is good that comforts and opportunities once confined to barons and earls have been made by enterprise the prerogatives of all. It was necessary to spread leisure, even though at first misused, before a wide culture could come. These multiplying inventions are the new organs with which we control our environment. We do not need to grow them on our bodies as animals must. We make them and use them and lay them aside till we need them again. We grow gigantic arms that build in a month the pyramids that once consumed 1,000,000 men. We make for ourselves great eyes that search out the invisible stars of the sky, and little eyes that peer into the invisible cells of life. We speak, if we wish, with quiet voices that reach across continents and seas. We move over the land and the air with the freedom of timeless gods. Granted that mere speed is worthless, it is a symbol of human courage and persistent will that the airplane has its highest meaning for us. Long chained like Prometheus to the earth, we have freed ourselves at last, and now we may look the eagle in the face. No, these tools will not conquer us. Our present defeat by the machinery around us is a transient thing, a halt in our visible progress to a slaveless world. The menial labor that degraded both master and man is lifted from human shoulders and harnessed to the tireless muscles of iron and steel. Soon, every waterfall and every wind will pour its beneficent energy into factories and homes, and man will be freed for the tasks of the mind. It is not revolution, but invention that will liberate the slave. 8. Science. In a large degree, Buckle was right. We progress only in knowledge, and these other gifts are rooted in the slow enlightenment of the mind. Here, in the untitled nobility of research and the silent battles of the laboratory, is a story fit to balance the chicanery of politics and the futile barbarism of war. Here man is at his best, and through darkness and persecution mounts steadily toward the light. Behold him standing on a little planet, measuring, weighing, analyzing constellations that he cannot see, predicting the vicissitudes of earth and sun and moon, and witnessing the birth and death of worlds. Or here is a seemingly unpractical mathematician tracking new formulas through laborious labyrinths, clearing the way for an endless chain of inventions that will multiply the power of his race. Here is a bridge, 100,000 tons of iron suspended from four ropes of steel, flung bravely from shore to shore, and bearing the passage of countless men. This is poetry as eloquent as Shakespeare ever wrote. Or consider this city-like building that mounts boldly into the sky, guarded against every strain by the courage of our calculations, and shining like diamond-studded granite in the night. Here in physics are new dimensions, new elements, new atoms, and new powers. Here in the rocks is the autobiography of life. Here in the laboratories, biology prepares to transform the organic world as physics transform matter. Everywhere you come upon them studying these unpretentious, unrewarded men, you hardly understand where the devotion finds its source and nourishment. They will die before the trees they plant will bear fruit for mankind, but they go on. Yes, it is true that this victory of man over matter has not yet been matched with any kindred victory of man over himself. The argument for progress falters here again. Psychology has hardly begun to comprehend, much less to control, human conduct and desire. It is mingled with mysticism and metaphysics, with psychoanalysis, behaviorism, glandular mythology, and other diseases of adolescence. Careful and modified statements are made only by psychologists of whom no one ever hears. In our country, the democratic passion for extreme statements turns every science into a fad. But psychology will outlive these ills and storms. It will be matured, like older sciences, by the responsibilities which it undertakes. If another Bacon should come to map out its territory, clarify the proper methods and objectives of its attack, and point out the fruits and powers to be won, which of us, knowing the surprises of history and the pertinacity of men, would dare set limits to the achievements that may come from our growing knowledge of the mind? Already in our day, man is turning round from his remade environment and beginning to remake himself. 9. Education. More and more completely, we pass on to the next generation the gathered experience of the past. It is almost a contemporary innovation, this tremendous expenditure of wealth and labor in the equipment of schools and the provision of instruction for all. Perhaps it is the most significant feature of our time. Once colleges were luxuries designed for the male half of the leisure class, today universities are so numerous that he who runs may become a PhD. We have not excelled the selected geniuses of antiquity, but we have raised the level and average of human knowledge far beyond any age in history. Think now not of Plato and Aristotle, but of the stupid, bigoted, and brutal Athenian assembly, of the unfranchised mob and its Orphic rites, of the secluded and enslaved women who could acquire education only by becoming courtesans. None but a child would complain that the world has not yet been totally remade by these spreading schools, these teeming bisexual universities. In the perspective of history, the great experiment of education has just begun. It has not had time to prove itself. It cannot, in a generation, undo the ignorance and superstition of 10,000 years. Indeed, there is no telling but the high rate of ignorance and the determination of dogma by plebiscite may triumph over education in the end. This step in progress is not one of which we may yet say that it is a permanent achievement of mankind, but already beneficent results appear. Why is it that tolerance and freedom of the mind flourish more easily in the northern states than in the south, if not because the south has not yet won wealth enough to build sufficient schools? Who knows how much of our preference for mediocrity in office and narrowness in leadership is the result of a generation recruited from regions too oppressed with economic need and political exploitation to spare time for the plowing and sowing of the mind? What will the full fruitage of education be when every one of us is schooled till 20 and finds equal access to the intellectual treasures of the race? Consider again the instinct of parental love, the profound impulse of every normal parent to raise his children beyond himself. Here is the biological leverage of human progress, a force more to be trusted than any legislation or any moral exhortation, because it is rooted in the very nature of man. Adolescence lengthens, we begin more helplessly, and we grow more completely toward that higher man who struggles to be born out of our darkened souls. We are the raw material of civilization. We dislike education because it was not presented to us in our youth for what it is. Consider it not as the painful accumulation of facts and dates, but as an ennobling intimacy with great men. Consider it not as the preparation of the individual to make a living, but as the development of every potential capacity in him for the comprehension, control, and appreciation of his world. Above all, consider it in its fullest definition as the technique of transmitting as completely as possible to as many as possible that technological, intellectual, moral, and artistic heritage through which the race forms the growing individual and makes him human. Education is the reason why we behave like human beings. We are hardly born human, we are born ridiculous and malodorous animals. We become human. We have humanity thrust upon us through the 100 channels whereby the past pours down into the present that mental and cultural inheritance, whose preservation, accumulation, and transmission place mankind today, with all its defectives and illiterates, on a higher plane than any generation has ever reached before. 10. Writing and print. Again, our imagination is too weak-winged to lift us to a full perspective. We cannot vision or recall the long ages of ignorance, impotence, and fear that preceded the coming of letters. Through those unrecorded centuries, men could transmit their hard-won lore only by word of mouth from parent to child. If one generation forgot or misunderstood, the weary ladder of knowledge had to be climbed anew. Writing gave a new permanence to the achievements of the mind. It preserved for thousands of years, and through a millennium of poverty and superstition, the wisdom found by philosophy and the beauty carved out in drama and poetry. It bound the generations together with a common heritage. It created that country of the mind in which, because of writing, genius need not die. And now, as writing united the generations, print, despite the thousand prostitutions of it, can bind the civilizations. It is not necessary anymore that civilization should disappear before our planet passes away. It will change its habitat. Doubtless the land in every nation will refuse at last to yield its fruit to improvident tillage and careless tenancy. Inevitably, new regions will lure with virgin soil the lustier strains of every race. But a civilization is not a material thing, inseparably bound like an ancient serf to a given spot of the earth. It is an accumulation of technical knowledge and cultural creation. If these can be passed on to the new seat of economic power, the civilization does not die. It merely makes for itself another home. Nothing but beauty and wisdom deserve immortality. To a philosopher, it is not indispensable that his native city should endure forever. He will be content if its achievements are handed down to form some part of the possessions of mankind. We need not fret then about the future. We are weary with too much war, and in our lassitude of mind we listen readily to a Spengler announcing the downfall of the Western world. But this learned arrangement of the birth and death of civilizations in even cycles is a trifle too precise. We may be sure that the future will play wild pranks with this mathematical despair. There have been wars before, and man and civilization survived them. Within 15 years after Waterloo, defeated France was producing so many geniuses that every attic in Paris was occupied. Never was our heritage of civilization and culture so secure, and never was it half so rich. We may do our little share to augment it and transmit it, confident that time will wear away chiefly the dross of it, and that what is finally fair and worthy in it will be preserved to illuminate many generations.